live from America's finest city. This is Real Talk San Diego on ESPN 1700. And now, your hosts, Ryan White and David McKelvin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Happy holidays to everybody out there. Thursday edition. It's Christmas. Wow. And we have with us today, Mark Urquhart. He is the owner, I guess co-owner, right? That's what you call yourself, in case your brother's listening?
Co-owner.
Co-owner, yeah, right.
We're really partners in the deal.
Got it. Of Real Bar and Bistro, his website. RealBarAndBistro.com is a restaurant that you've opened in Solana Beach. How long have you been there?
We'll be 2 years in January.
2 years in January, so relatively new.
Yes.
Got it. So one more time, Real Bar and Bistro, and the website is RealBarAndBistro.com. Now, I have Mark on today because I wanted to kind of talk about what it's like to go out and procure commercial space and then run a business that supports three children. Right? And your brother, does he have children as well?
No. I don't think his wife's born yet.
Is that, okay, excellent. Okay, good enough. Well, so you're doing it. You're serving food, and we'll certainly get into exactly what that is, but running a business that makes enough money to support, you live here in Solana Beach in the community you serve. And how young is your youngest? Young, right?
Yeah, she's 3 months.
3 months, so. That's young.
Yeah,
that's
she young. Doesn't eat much, which is that's good.
Okay. So let's talk about first what you did before you became a restaurateur.
Well, I graduated college in 2000 with a theology and finance degree from the University of Notre Dame. I really realized very quickly that theology was not going to carry me very far. So I entered into the commercial real estate realm. I worked for Coldwell Banker up in Carlsbad. For about 4 years. I also spent some time with Joe Bala, who's a local Solana Beach guy, at Retail Properties Group. After about 4 years, I realized I didn't want to be subjected to, I think, the whims of the economy as much as as I was going through at that time in commercial real estate. Early 2000 was up and down. So I started pursuing a career in medical. So I spent about 10 years in medical sales, focusing primarily on advanced visualization for cardiovascular imaging. Basically, it's a fancy way of saying a 3D model of your heart. And I would sell that to hospitals over five states. And I was pretty successful at it. It was a good gig. It required a lot of attention to detail, a lot of positioning your product in a very competitive marketplace with some big hitters. The company that I worked for primarily in the cardiovascular imaging realm was a small company, so it was very agile. It relied a lot on relationship building. It relied a lot of it on separating yourself from the big boys, the GEs and the Toshibas and those types of companies. So we had to be very agile in the marketplace, which had a large focus on marketing. After that, after about 5 years, really, I was up in San Francisco and I was having dinner at a restaurant in Little Italy portion of San Francisco called North Beach. And I had a chance to, eat at, Tony Gemignani's restaurant. Tony is a very charismatic guy. He's basically the guru of pizza in the country. There might be one other, and that would be Chris Bianco out of Phoenix. While I was eating there, I had probably the best pizza I've had ever, even up to date. Which
okay.
And even though that's all I do now, and I mean that's how good he is. And I asked him, and he was very gracious with his time. And I asked him, I said, how do you do this? I mean, how do you make a product so good? He said, well, it's just flour, water, yeast, and salt. So at the time, I was thinking, one, I wanted to ultimately work for myself, but I was never going to invent the next CT. I was never going to invent the next software component for cardiovascular imaging. So I was looking for a product that was simple. And that's how I found it. I stumbled upon it at that restaurant.
Wow. And so from then on, you decided, I want to dedicate my life to pizzas and the surrounding dishes.
Yes, that's exactly right. I took a class up in San Francisco from Tony shortly after, and where we really dug into the science behind pizza. I mean, it's amazing, but
there's science behind it.
There's science, more than just eating it. It's a chemical reaction, really, of binding proteins, which creates that gluten structure. It's how the yeast eats the simple sugars, which is basically what makes it so. This pizza in particular, it's so easy to digest. It's so light. It's so airy. There are a few other Napolitano pizza restaurants in San Diego that understand and appreciate this, and they do a fantastic job as well. And it really creates a unique product that it doesn't weigh you down. It's not thinking of pizza in a conventional American fashion. It's supposed to be an Italian fashion where you can have a whole pizza and then go for a jog afterward. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it really is the case when you have high quality ingredients and you do things the right way.
We're talking with Mark Urquhart. He's the owner, co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro here in Solana Beach. And you had mentioned that the type of pizza you serve is Napolitano. That's a description of the dough. Is that what that means?
It's really a style overall.
Okay.
I mean, Napolitano is going to be Italian ingredients. We don't use actually Italian ingredients. That's kind of what separates us. But I refer to Napolitano as a style. It's limited. It only allows you to use four ingredients, and we don't use Italian ingredients because we like to source locally as possible. So, for example, our flour is grown in Montana and in Kansas, and we want to keep things in the United States, and it's sourced and distributed through a company in San Francisco. I mean, we buy our salt from San Francisco. We buy locally in San Diego as much as possible. We partner with Baker and Olive and some of the local farms. That's why we don't go strictly Italian. I'd rather support the local community.
So when you say that you're limited to four ingredients because of the style, right?
Correct.
You're talking about what goes on top. You're talking about what's in the sauce. You're talking about what's in the dough. What is that you're talking about?
The dough itself. Got it.
Which is what you mentioned before. Say them again.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It's flour, water, yeast, and salt.
Sounds easy, right?
Simple.
Yeah, how hard could that be?
It's not.
Okay, got it. But the ratios are pretty important, I would imagine.
It's the ratios, and something that sounds simple on the surface is not always simple once you start to dig deep. It's how we leaven the dough and proof it. It's how we create a starter, a biga, and it's the process by which we go through that makes our dough unique.
Well, what does that mean? You're talking restaurantese over there. What does it mean to leaven and proof the dough?
Well, to leaven the dough is basically there are a few different components. One is the protein level of the flour is important. So, for example, what makes a New York pizza is that it has a high protein ratio. So that might be 14%, 15%, or 14.5% really to proteins. That creates the binding agent for the dough. That's why New York pizza is able to stretch so thin and get so far. It has a crisp texture. Napolitano is going to be more like a bread flour. It's going to be closer to about 12% protein. So it's going to bind, but not bind as much as a New York. It's going to have a softer feel, softer texture. And then what we do is we add yeast to the product, and the yeast is going to eat all the simple sugars that are in the dough itself. And the offput is going to be carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is what creates the leavening of the dough. And so there's different ways that you handle that leavening. You can slow it down and cool it, which is one of the things that we do. And by cooling it down, it creates a tangy sort of flavor profile. That's what it starts to verge on more of a sourdough. And then everybody has their own twist. Some people like more of a yeasty flavor. Some people like more of a sour flavor. It just depends on your particular palate and what you like, and also what you're going to put on it. So we hover right in between of really like a tangy and a yeasty flour.
You really are a graduate of pizza school.
Yeah, I know. That's my my college degree is paying off.
It's your college degree is paying off. Okay. Okay, wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about the shop there. So you're in business with your brother, yep. right? And so we asked about, is there restauranting in your family background? And you told me a story about your dad and grandfather in the donut shop. Tell us a little bit about that.
So my background is not personally not entrenched in the restaurant industry. However, my dad and his dad owned a donut shop in Monterey Park in Los Angeles. And he didn't know anything about the restaurant industry either or making donuts. But what he did understand is freshness and quality. Ironically, when he opened up the restaurant, he was known as the donut shop that had sinkers. They were cooked so poorly that they literally just sank to the bottom of the fryer. And it was a terrible product. I mean, it was awful. But he reached out to the local community. He reached out to the distributors and to the manufacturers of the products that he was using, and really got a very detailed oriented understanding of donuts. And then what he did is he was dedicated to quality. So, for example, what a lot of people do, a lot of donut shops do.
Well, let me stop you right here. Dedicated sure. to quality is the important part, right?
Yes.
And before we give away the secret recipe that he did, when we come back, we're going to go through exactly the process he did and how he separated himself, and more importantly, how you're using the same concept to separate yourself ahead of us when we come back. Bistro, their website, realbarandbistro.com. And he's telling us a little bit about the ingenuity that is in his blood with respect to food, and how his father took his donut business from, I guess, being called a sinker, right?
Correct.
To I would imagine, a thriving practice. Go ahead and tell us what he did.
Well, I think it's, and I think what my grandfather did was he always had an attention to detail and an understanding of what people want. And as he started out his donut shop in LA, he realized that a lot of the local donut makers and donut shops would make all of their donuts for the entire day at one time. And this is an early morning business. This is, you're making donuts at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. By the time 10 o'clock rolls around, those donuts are seven hours old. There are no preservatives. There's nothing that's keeping these things alive. There's no packaging. I mean, you have to go back 50 years where we didn't really even have any of these preservatives and these types of things in our food that are going to make basically like a Twinkie. So what he did, which really set him apart, is he didn't cut any corners. And he was dedicated to providing fresh product. And what I mean by that is he would make small batches of doughs more frequently. And as a result, when the person's getting off of work at, 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, they're going to stop and they're going to have a nice, hot, fresh donut. Or the person's going to work at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, they're going to have the equally fresh product as the person who is going to work at, say, 7 o'clock. He would make donuts at 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock, all the way throughout the entire day. He would have the same quota, but every customer that came in would have a fresh product. And if anybody's had out there a piping hot, fresh donut, there's nothing like it. I mean, that's what Krispy Kreme's entire model is based on. Not that is the same kind of product, but it's to convey the freshness and the quality and biting into something that's just, that melts in your mouth. And that's really what he did that separated him. He was so successful at it. I mean, he expanded to a few other locations and did very well. from a guy who really started out knowing nothing about the business.
We're talking with Mark Urquhart. He is the owner of Real Bar and Bistro, talking about how being innovative in the restaurant space is in his blood, if you will. And although the idea of making food fresh to order is not revolutionary when it comes to being a restaurant, really what I think we take from that is the idea that you make everything in-house, right? That's you mentioned right. to me sauerkraut, pickles,
it's a bratwurst.
Thank you, bratwurst. You make it all in-house.
We make everything from scratch. With a name like Real, there's a lot of pressure. We did that intentionally. We wanted to convey authenticity, and when you're authentic, you really don't require a lot of ingredients. More simple, the better. For example, we don't use any dried herbs. We stem our own thyme, we stem our own oregano. We're committed to quality, and what that requires, though, is a tremendous amount of labor and a tremendous amount of skill. We don't have high school kids making our pizzas. I mean, the guys making our pizzas are five diamond sous chefs from the Ritz in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I mean, that's the kind of quality of person that we have at our restaurant. And as a result, we have people with skills. And when they have the skills, they apply them. They have pride and integrity into their really what is their trade. And as a result, we make things, and it requires a little bit of labor, and it requires patience and time. So, for example, as you mentioned, we do our own sauerkraut. But sauerkraut is incredibly easy. It's just a matter of having the conviction to be authentic. I mean, sauerkraut is simple. It's cabbage and salt over time. It takes 6 weeks to make. That's all. So when we actually drop, our own bratwurst, we make our own mustard from scratch, and we have one of our appetizers is that served in a cast iron plate. We drop it in front of the guest, and they say, "Wow, that was fast," because it cooks in a 900 degree oven, and it cooks in about a minute and a half for a bratwurst. And they go, "Wow, that's fast." And they go, "Yeah, it only took 6 weeks." That's it.
So getting back to, let's go back just a second. Let's talk about what goes in. I understand it just requires salt, right? Salt and cabbage.
Correct.
That's it. But so what you're serving today, you began the process 6 weeks ago. Right?
Exactly.
I would imagine you don't make it every day. You make it once a week, or you're not making it in tiny batches, right? You're
correct.
Something of batches. So it's in there aging.
Yes, it's basically fermented food, which is it's probably not the most appetizing way of expressing it, but it's a traditional way of making food. Our chef, Chef Jason, who joined us from Bistro West up in Carlsbad, managed a 4-acre farm. I mean, you want to talk about patience in menu planning and menu design, and yet still a lot of attention to detail. I mean, when you are managing a farm, you're not just plucking out of the farm what happens to be growing there. You have to design a menu 10 months in advance, and then plant seeds, and then harvest it, but also take into consideration the possible yield. For example, it might not rain. It might get too cold. It might, it will decrease your ability to harvest the actual product. When we first opened, we have arugula in a lot of our dishes. There was a huge freeze in January of 2012, and it destroyed pretty much the entire arugula crop, and we couldn't get it. We couldn't get it at all. So I actually, in a moment of desperation and being open for about a month, I ran over to Sprouts and bought their entire inventory of arugula just to get us through. But I mean, when you're designing a menu, and when you're trying to create a product that has these variables into it, you have to be flexible, you have to be ingenious, but you also have to be true to keeping it as a quality product. So there's challenges out there.
Well, we're going to build up to the bratwurst, because that's, I'm sure, the most important. But tell me how you go about making a pickle. I mean, I would think it's relatively simple, but I bet you're going to have some technical way to do it.
It's really simple. It's a mixture of different spices that are basically called pickling spices. Mm-hmm. And we take cucumbers, and we put them in a batch, and it takes about 2 weeks for us to make them. And we make a huge batch at once, and the pickling spices just infuse into the pickle. What's probably the most important part of this process, though, is cleanliness. So I would say we're pretty surgical in our commitment to being clean, and that's how we can maintain a quality product. It's just like if you were to make wine and the wrong bacteria gets into the wine, it's going to change the overall flavor component. Hence, like a corked wine, and we're just going to have that kind of wet mop kind of taste and smell. So we have to be careful because we're timing everything. So our inventory runs out as our new product is available.
Right.
So if it's not perfect, then we're kind of in a pickle, if you will.
So a lot more goes beyond, you know, ordering the ingredients, because once the ingredients show up, you still got to do something with them. It's 6 weeks. You know, how long did it take to make a pickle?
It takes about 2 weeks.
2 weeks. God, that's what you said already. Yeah. So 6 months for your sauerkraut. You really have to plan things ahead.
Yeah, we do. We do. Everything is very, we have a lot of conversations because Chef Jason and I and my brother are constantly evolving. We have to adjust to what's available. And then we also have to continually improve our product in any way that we can. So it just requires a commitment to communication, really. I mean, we talk a lot about our menu. And
my wife always is asking me for a commitment communication. Every day she wants a commitment to communication. Well, that's great that you have that.
Yeah, it's required.
Okay, so I would think bratwurst is one of the more complicated things you make there. You told me a little bit about the process, but go through that bratwurst making process again.
Well, it's actually pretty, I mean, again, it's simple. I mean, again, we're talking about making cabbage. It's two ingredients. With time being involved. So for a bratwurst, it's the same. We take a pork shoulder, we grind it down from scratch. Then we add our specific spice blend to it, which each ingredient is fresh. We don't use any dried herbs. So all of our garlic, we're chopping from scratch. All of our fennel, we're gonna brown it toast it and add a little nuttiness to it. And then we put all those ingredients and we actually blend it in and emulsify it to create the right texture. So if you don't do that, then the actual product starts to separate a little bit and the emulsification creates just a really nice soft mouthfeel. Then we take a hog encasing and we encase it ourselves. So ultimately, it's really simple. It's just knowing how to do it and spending the time and not cutting the corners.
So if I ordered a bratwurst sandwich at your place, there's a chance I would be getting sauerkraut made in-house, pickles made in-house. You mentioned mustard.
Yes. Right?
You guys make that too. What goes into making mustard?
Well, mustard is simple. It's just mustard seed and vinegar, and we actually infuse ours with Stone IPA.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, so three ingredients.
Well, there's salt and there's some other ingredients.
Yeah. Stone IPA.
Yeah. Yeah, we do that. It comes out pretty like almost like a horseradish and kind of mustard.
So on my bratwurst sandwich, I'd be getting potentially homemade sauerkraut, homemade pickles, homemade mustard, and of course the bratwurst itself.
Correct.
All made right there, real, I guess one would say, right?
Real, from scratch.
We'll talk with Mark Urquhart. He is the co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro. Their website, realbarandbistro.com. That's the website, realbarandbistro.com. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the site location, kind of get into the commercial real estate aspect of the restaurant ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour. We've got Mark Urquhart. He is the co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro, their website, realbarandbistro.com. We're talking about how they're making everything in-house and sourcing locally, which is kind of what you're basing the concept of the restaurant on, right?
Correct.
Okay, good enough. So we promised to talk a little bit about the commercial real estate aspect of it. And I would imagine, when you decided to source this location. This location has some unique, let's say, pizza history, which we'll also talk about. But I would imagine there's other aspects that went into it. So why did you choose one Solana Beach, but why this particular spot, knowing that I'm sure there's a lot of other to choose from?
Well, a lot goes into the decision. And one of the things that we were considering with this particular location was the demographics. I grew up in the area. My brother grew up in the area. We're both fourth generation San Diegans, and which is actually unique in itself. But I remember receiving my Little League trophy at the former pizza restaurant that was there. It was a Round Table Pizza, and there's just a lot of history there. We didn't necessarily want to continue what Round Table was doing. We wanted to become different, and I'd say be a little more sophisticated, a little more neighborhoody. When we took over the space, it was actually scraped. The landlord wanted to try to lease it to us, but they realized that they couldn't. It was the Round Table was 30 years old, so there was some deferred maintenance, to say the least. So when we took it over, we had a decision to make. How do we want to build this out? It's a blank palette, and we went into this concept as a place that wanted to, I think, become a little more upscale, I think befitting the demographics of the area. Honestly, in Solana Beach, you have the surrounding areas, it's including Solana Beach. You have Solana Beach, Rancho Santa Fe, Del Mar, Carmel Valley, Cardiff, Encinitas, Carlsbad, probably the best demographics per capita in the country. I can't think of a place that has a higher density of sophistication, college education, and those types of things. And so all those things went into the decision on how to build the place out. So when we took it over, we decided to go, timeless was really our theme. We wanted to be so timeless because at the time, reclaimed wood and those types of build outs were very in vogue. They're very hip. And we're also noticing, though, at the same time, that they're starting to go away a little bit. What defines trends is really what's affordable at the time. And at the time that reclaimed wood became popular and that sort of decor and concrete floors were popular is during the middle of the recession. And those were the least expensive building materials you could get. So people doctored them up, made them look beautiful. But we wanted to be more timeless. So when we built it out, we built out Carrara marble countertops, mahogany ceilings. We actually have it looks like wood, but it's actually a porcelain floor. Being a restaurant, it's got to be indestructible for the floor. But we didn't want to do concrete. We wanted to have texture and color and soft colors. And, I remember when we built out, our contractor said, whatever you do, don't put marble in there. Marble's going to stain. Marble's going to go away. It's going to get chipped. It's going to it's just not going to hold up. And I asked him. I said, really? Because the Vatican is still there. I mean, marble doesn't go away. It might wear. It might weather. But that's the look we want. We want it to weather. So there are stains on the marble that now that we've been open for 2 years, but it's starting to stain and create weathered patterns. And it's a nice look. It's a look we wanted to have from the beginning, but it takes time to get the look that you want, and so we're very pleased and with the ambiance. When you come in, we get compared to downtown Manhattan, we get compared to downtown San Francisco, but at the same time, from the exterior of the building, you would never guess that we're in there. So we also carry off a little bit of a speakeasy vibe, and in that, you really have to walk through our doors to see it. Otherwise, you would never know. There are particular challenges with our location, too. Yes, there was a Round Table there previously, but there was no real base. Round Table had been out for over 2 years. So we really had to have an ambiance inside that was enticing to get people to come back. Some of the other challenges from a real estate perspective of our location are we're below grade. We have no we butt up against the freeway, but we have no freeway signage. You have to get through a camera light to get to us.
Now, the freeway signage, is that something that the owner of the community won't allow, I have to assume?
Yeah, it's a landlord restriction that they I'm not sure exactly why, but it's I checked with the city. They were okay with us having signage on this freeway, but I think the landlord is going for a particular look, and so we were, you know, prohibited
it's
from having
no-go.
It's a no-go for not only us but all the tenants on that side.
Well, so you talked a little bit about, you know, building it out. What is the size of your, I guess let's call it the first chunk that you opened?
The first chunk was 2,400 square feet.
2,400 square feet. Yeah. Okay. And quickly after being open, you had the opportunity to enclose the neighbor, right? And kind of bring that into the fold as well.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And that was, make sure I have this right, that was a restaurant. It was then downzoned to a retail space that you then had to bring back up to a restaurant space again. Do I have that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So Roundtable had been there for almost 30 years, 25 years.
So it was Roundtable. It was they put a wall down and broke off.
Yes. So, I mean, simply stated, Roundtable had 4,000 square feet about.
I see. Okay.
About. And there was actually a small jewelry shop that was there as well. So when the landlord took over the space, they moved the jewelry shop and Roundtable was gone. So it made 4,000 contiguous square feet of rentable square footage. So when we took it over, the landlord asked us to take over one specific side. So that side was part of Roundtable. They put in a Sprint, they put in a demising wall and put Sprint in into Suite 126, which is now our expanded space. Sprint, as a result, when they took over the Roundtable space, it was a downgrade in occupancy. And Roundtable, as you can imagine, over 25 years, there are a lot of code changes. There are a lot of fire restrictions and occupancy restrictions that are now in place, parking requirements that are now in place, that Roundtable was grandfathered into.
Mm-hmm.
Had we taken over just specifically Roundtable Pizza, then we would have been grandfathered into it because there would have not been a use change. However, that isn't the way it went down. It Roundtable turned into Sprint. Sprint is a retailer, which changed all the code requirements when we took that space over.
So as an example, Sprint only required a certain amount of parking spaces per square footage of store, which is less than would be required for a restaurant.
Exactly.
I see. And so how did you get around that?
Well, the city of Solana Beach and the landlord were very helpful in that respect. It required some creativity.
Okay.
But everything is to code and everything is correctly done. But it was just a matter of identifying parking spaces that are available in other areas of the mall in order to satiate the code requirement.
Got it. And so
or satisfy, I guess.
You started with 2,400 and you've now have how much? What's the new space? How big is that?
It's 4,000 feet.
So total. So you really have all of Roundtable now.
We have all.
you eventually taken over all of Roundtable.
Yes.
Got it. So that is really funny because I know my wife and brother-in-law have both talked to me about their memories, just like you mentioned about sitting there with their AYSO or Little League trophy and their team party at Roundtable. It was an installation there for many, many years.
Right. Yeah. It is. I mean, I mentioned to you before, I received my Little League trophy there.
Yeah.
And that's not when they gave everybody a Little League trophy. I had to earn my third place.
Third place. Excellent. So with the understanding, and you mentioned Del Mar, Carmel Valley, Rancho, Cardiff, Encinitas, Carlsbad, all I would imagine are potential areas you could have opened your restaurant. Why Solana Beach and why this particular location?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. One of them is it's a business decision, and a lot of landlords are not interested in small businesses. They're not interested in local businesses, and they put in chains. You may notice that in suburbia, or North County, San Diego, and in a lot of suburban areas throughout the country, the immediate compulsion for landlords is to go to credit tenants, and there's a security in there for them. That doesn't necessarily mean that having a franchise is going to ensure some sort of success, but it gives a credit to that company. So we're not a mom and pop, we're brother, and we're independently capitalized, and we're going into this with a lot of from a landlord perspective, it could be perceived as a lot of trepidation on the success in our, of our business plan. But I mean, we entered it into with no debt. I mean, we paid for it from scratch because, well, we did well. I did well in my previous life. And,
Okay.
And,
okay.
And as a result, we were able to enter into this with my brother as a collaboration and create something that's very special. And a lot of landlords don't, they'd rather have the credit than have the quality. And so it's easy to put in a chain restaurant. So it's not that so much that we had our choice of any place. But this landlord in particular, they saw what we're trying to do. And when I first met with them and I just was describing our business plan and business model, I don't think they really understood it, to be honest. It wasn't until one of the leasing agents had a chance to go to Portland and they went up to a restaurant called Oven and Shaker. And they had a pizza there and a cocktail and they realized, is that what you're trying to do? And I said, yes, that's what we're trying to do. And he said, and I said, this is our business plan. He goes, I get it now. I see what you're trying to do. He says, that's exactly what we want. And as a result, you know, it's done pretty well for us. So it's all we needed was a shot. A lot of landlords wouldn't have done that.
Well, one of the leasing agents eventually caught on.
Yeah, San Diego is an interesting marketplace. It's, it has the ocean to the west and Camp Pendleton to the north and Mexico to the south. So in the mountains to the east. And so in some ways and respects, it's a little bit isolated from the most cutting edge trends. And so it's hard sometimes for even landlords to identify exactly what concept you're going with. And not only that, can this person execute it? And
well, I'm glad they decided to take a risk on you, I guess, huh? Right?
Well, it's a risk, but we built it out pretty beautifully. I mean, it's an asset to the entire, I think, to the entire area.
I think so, too. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Mark Edgart. He is the co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro. Talk about what's new in 2015. Talk more specifically about the pizza, not necessarily from a scientific perspective, but maybe from a dining perspective. And also about New Year's Eve ahead of us. We come back. Mark Urquhart in studio talking about Real Bar and Bistro. His website is realbarandbistro.com. Now, you didn't originally open under that name, right? You started as Real Food and Spirits, correct?
That's correct.
And I think this kind of plays into what you're going to say a little about the menu here later on, is your name evolved, right? And why did that happen?
Well, like any idealized version of what you want to do when you open up a new business in a community, you can do as many demographic studies as you want, but ultimately you're going to open up with a specific concept. And our specific concept when we opened was pizzas, burgers, and salads. And then when we opened, the city of Solana Beach said, that's nice. I'm happy for you. But we want you to be like this. We want you to either be like the round table or we want you to be something different than you are. And ultimately, there's a coming together. And there's an evolution in a restaurant that's new and it's independently owned. It's not a chain. So we have flexibility. We can do anything we want at any time. We can be agile within the marketplace and we can adapt. And we have. And one of the adaptation has been our name. So when we opened up as Real Food and Spirits, there was confusion in the community because it's in a strip mall. And like I said, it doesn't look like a 1920s French cafe on the outside. It looks like a strip mall in Solana Beach. And so people were confused. They thought we were a supermarket. And we, I think, got a little too cute. Originally, it was my decision to name it Real Food and Spirits because I wanted to describe what we are. What are we? Food that's real. It's authentic. It's clean. It's from scratch. Oh, and by the way, we do cocktails too. It's full bar. So it's spirits. That really kind of honestly, it was a very challenging thing to overcome because it made people think of us from an outsider's perspective. As you're driving past us on Loma Santa Fe, you're going to see food and spirits and you're going to think supermarket. It also doesn't help that there was a British food shop in a location that was very close to where we're located, and people had known it for a long time. But in the community, it's challenging because the British food place had been closed for over 5 years before we had even opened. People associated us with it. Yeah.
So now you've evolved.
So we evolved and we changed the name to Real Bar and Bistro. And it's funny where you get your resources. There's also in the same center, there's a Cleaners. It's called Premier Cleaners. But nobody seems to pay any attention to the fact that their name is Premier. It's a Cleaners, and that's what it says on all their signs in big bold letters. Cleaners. Cleaners. So yes, we are real and that's our name, to convey the authenticity and how we do things. But really what we need is instant name recognition and an instant identification of who we are. And that is a bar and a bistro.
Well, you had mentioned that you had changed your menu based on what your diners told you. How did you get the feedback from them that pizza, burgers, and salads wasn't enough?
Feedback is very simple to interpret. It's based on frequency of visits and sales, really. I mean, when you have a guest that comes in and says, I love this place. I love being here. You guys have the best pizza around. That's very flattering. But it's not flattering when they say, and I'll see you next week when I come back for pizza again. So, I mean, the restaurant industry is a volume business, and you need people to have reasons to come back frequently. So in this neighborhood, it's a very community conscious neighborhood.
Very much so.
It's and they enjoy what we do, but they're not going to eat pizza every day. Mm-hmm. So we had to evolve. We had to evolve our menu. That's why we have a bratwurst. I mean, yeah, okay, we're Italian. I understand we're Italian. Most of our dishes are Italian. We make our pastas from scratch. Like, we literally make our pastas from scratch. It's not just a cliche. So
really do.
Yeah, and you can tell the difference. But we want to evolve into other things, and we want to keep things interesting and keep us on the mind of the people that live in the community. And what I found is since we've evolved our menu, we sell a lot more entrees. We sell almost as many entrees as we do pizzas now.
Well, so let's talk about how the menu has evolved thus far, and let's talk about what it is going to evolve to in the future. Now, you mentioned three different types of pizzas.
Yes.
Styles, I guess I should say, right? What is it?
So we've done a classic Napolitano pizza, which we've talked about. And then we also do a classic New York style. Again, it requires a different flour and some different process in making that style of pizza. And really, it's the foundation. It's the dough that makes the difference. Now, this weekend, we're going to start a new style because we're in the winter. It's a Chicago style. Again, it's paying attention to your demographics and what's around you. There are very few places in North County whatsoever that actually offer a deep dish. And, you know, while we offer a lot of items, appetizers and entrees alike, that are not pizza, we're pretty good at pizza. So it's so adding the deep dish and making it on point in a classic Chicago style it's going to be a nice complement to our menu.
And naturally, you already have the facilities to accommodate the oven, right?
Yeah, three ovens.
It's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, excellent. So coming up, you've got a New Year's Eve event, mm-hmm. right, that happens a little bit different. I mean, we're done by 9:30. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, I have three kids. And so some of it is a bit selfish, but again, it's because I like to be with my family, like everybody does on New Year's Eve, and I like to ring in the new year with my wife and my kids. And but this year, we wanted to do something a little bit different, so we're offering an East Coast New Year's. So we're getting the New York feed for the ball drop, and we're gonna have a live band. We have a cabaret license, so we do live music all the time, Tuesdays and Fridays, in fact. But this New Year's Eve, we're going to have a blues band. It's going to be a six-string guitar, a bass, and we have a baby grand piano where that'll be involved in it as well. And we're going to ring in the new year at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock sharp.
9 o'clock, it's done. And then whatever it takes to wrap up after that.
That's right. So we'll continue music going till about 9:30. And but the idea is really we want to have people enjoy their New Year's Day and not wake up exhausted. And in this community, again, it's a community-oriented, family-oriented community. And a lot of people have early morning obligations with kids getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and
sure,
and they don't want to be up till midnight.
Plus, no, I can't remember the last time I saw the ball drop at actually midnight our time.
Yeah, you get a chance to celebrate it though, as if it was real time, and then it's an easy walk or short drive home. And
yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're talking with Mark Urquhart. He is the co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro. Their website is realbarandbistro.com. One more time, realbarandbistro.com. You still have seats available for the New Year's event, right?
Yep.
So tell me what's new in 2015 for Real.
Well, we're really excited about it. A new concept that... It's takeout, and takeout thought of in, I think, an unconventional sense. Basically, what we're doing is we're doing cast irons, a cast iron crusade, where we cook an entire meal for you. And what we're going to make duck cassoulets, jambalayas, shrimp gumbos, lasagnas, different things, one every day of the week. And what it is what we're doing is we're offering time for parents. The time for the parents is essentially they don't have to cook, but they get a high quality home cooked meal that's ready and packaged for them to go. The vegetables and the starches are going to be taken out in to-go containers that are going to be disposable. So there are very few dishes other than your own dishes and forks and knives. And so it's a way of really buying people time, so that they can enjoy each other's company, two working parents, or just people who want a night off from cooking.
So when I walk out of Real with my to-go food, it's ready to go, or I still assemble it, I still heat it, it's unheated? How does that process work?
It's ready to go.
It's ready to go.
All you have to do, if you want, which may not necessarily even be necessary, is if you're going to eat it maybe an hour or two later, you would just put it in your oven. There'll be cooking instructions. All you have to do is bring it up to temperature.
Got it. So, but when I leave your shop, it's cooked, it's at temperature, it's ready to go.
Exactly.
Got it. So it's takeout. I mean, there's no way around it. It's takeout, ready to go, but it's home cooked.
Yes, but it's also in a cast iron, so it'll retain heat really well.
All right. Cast iron. So, of course, you got to bring the cast iron back.
Yes. Of course.
Wonderful. Well, again, one more time, we're talking with Mark Urquhart. He is the co-owner of Real Bar and Bistro, his website, realbarandbistro.com. That's his website. realbarandbistro.com. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ryan.
To all of you out there, happy holidays. Thank you.